speak here. The work I'm going to talk about today was done with Joseph Macheco, Xiaolong Qi, and Xu Zhengzheng from Stanford. And my talk is going to try to cover two things. For one, I'm going to try to tell you the results of that paper, but also in a much more broader sense, I'm going to try to tell you the things I learned while working with those folks and try to give you once more a review about topological insulators, but from a point of view of somebody who spent a lot of time thinking about relativistic field theories in the past. I hope this will be illuminating to the people like me who kind of like the language and to maybe some of my condensed matter colleagues who like to hear a different perspective of what they've been doing all along. All right, so the basic question that this topological insulator business tries to address is, you know, to answer the question of what is the generic low energy effective theory describing insulator. And you know, our general rules for low energy active field theories is you have to identify the relevant degrees of freedom, and then you just write down the most general action consistent with symmetries in a derivative expansion. So for an insulator, this sounds like a really simple exercise. An insulator is a gap system. So the only low energy degrees of freedom that's left is the Maxwell field itself. So your task is just write down the most general action for an electric field and magnetic field consistent with symmetries up to two derivatives. E and B are vectors, so you can write down dot products, and then naively you're left with this. The only two things you can write down are E squared and B squared. You stick some random coefficients out front. If you're on the level of the low energy effective, so you're undetermined. In principle, you can get out of a matching against the UV theory. And these then you call the permittivity and the permeability. And then the rest from there on seems to be just Jackson physics. While you grind through this, you can generate a lot of interesting textbook problems. You can get some interesting physics out of it. But there doesn't seem to be much more to the story. Well, there's one more term you can write down with two vectors. You can not just have E squared and B squared, you can also have E dot B. So what's the reason that this is usually not included in Jackson textbooks? And there are more symmetries than just rotation invariants. There's parity and time reversal. Parity, we don't care that much about, it's often broken. But under time reversal, you would say that no, the electric field is even, the magnetic field is odd. So if you want to not just describe any sort of odd insulator, but an insulator which respects time reversal, you think you should not write down the term because it's a time reversal odd term. And if you only want to write down time reversal even terms, you're stuck with permittivity and permeability. Well, that was a little fast if you think about the system on a quantum level. The basic thing that makes this term interesting is the basic physical effect is that magnetic fluxes are quantized. So one way to think about this is the first thing about Dirac quantization, that if there were a magnetic charge, it would have to be quantized. And the direct consequence of this is that if you take an integral of a magnetic flux across any closed two surface, you're going to have a basic flux quantum. Now, most people in this room probably would accept that magnetic fluxes have to be quantized. Even they probably do not like about thinking about Dirac quantization as the best way to get there. But no, the basic feature that makes this an interesting term is that magnetic fluxes have to be quantized. As a consequence, if you look at this particular term, which was a relativistic version of writing E dot B, that will be with this one factor of alpha out front. That term, that quantity, which is just a magnetic flux squared, at least if you think of your theory of living on a Euclidean closed four manifold, that will have to be an integer. Will be an integer if you stick out the right factors of pi out front. As a consequence of this, if you think about the partition function of the system, anything you calculate from a Pearson integral which has a factor of e to the I action sitting there, you find that this turns out to be e to the I n times this parameter theta, which was, after I took out the alpha and the 32 pi squared, the coefficient in the action of this f which f term, the e dot b term. Okay, what this tells you is at the quantum level, your theory, all the quantities you might want to calculate, they're actually periodic in when theta changes from theta to theta plus 2 pi. And that's the abelian version of the well-known theta vacuum and QCD. Theta is time reversal odd, as we discussed before. E is time reversal even, B is time reversal odd. So if you the theta parameter is time reversal odd. But so if theta goes to theta to minus theta and theta has an equivalence with theta gets shifted by 2 pi, then you can actually make a time reversal invariant insulator, not just with theta equals zero, but also with theta equals pi. Pi goes to minus pi, but minus pi and pi are the same thing on the quantum level in the partition function. Nothing can tell apart whether you had pi or minus pi. So there is a C2 classification of time reversal invariant insulators.
Do you think that the electromagnetic U1 is part of some grand unified group or something? Isn't that the
synthesis
argument?
No, I need to. I need to make sure that I need to be this compact U1, I need to make sure that my magnetic fluxes are quantized. So if my all electric charges in the system come as an integer multiple of the electron charge E, magnetic fluxes are quantized, then I get an integer here. And I will use this later, so I'm glad you asked. This condition will get modified if you allow electric charges which are not integer multiples of E. For example, if you allow Krebsian charges, we'll get different consequences. But it's same. In a grand unified sphere, that would be guaranteed to you that all electric charges are integer multiples of E. But in nature, we don't have any reason to think that the electric charges are just square root 2 times E. But if there were such things, then this quantization condition would be completely changed. Magnetic fluxes are quantized. No, we have a good.
But there's nothing in the theory that demands that physically theoretic theta, right? Unless there's some underlying reason.
There is. The quantization of electric charge implies the quantization of magnetic charge, implies the quantization of magnetic fluxes, therefore, physically theoretic theta. As long as magnetic fluxes are quantized, if you can have a magnetic flux which is a real number times what we would consider a flux quantum, this wouldn't work. But as long as magnetic fluxes are quantized, physically periodic and same. Okay, so Clarkson should have really written down a third parameter. When he wrote his textbooks, general insulators characterized by three numbers, epsilon, mu, and zeta, that those can take in any real number you want, but zeta can only be 0.5. And since we mostly deal with zeta equals 0, those we call the topological trivial insulators, and the ones that zeta equals pi, these are the non-trivial insulators. So where could this zeta come from? Let me write down, before I go there, first let's just talk about what it does, then we can talk about where it comes from. So this zeta term is a total derivative. In the absence of any interface, it really doesn't do anything. It can be absorbed in the definition of E and B. Even so, if you're dealing with interfaces, it's better to leave it there and have it explicitly contribute to your equations of motion by modifying the definition of the D and H quantities that you usually introduce when you have matter around. But really, the only physical consequence it has, it introduces some interesting new effects when you introduce domain walls, and a boundary of a topological insulator and a vacuum is a domain wall across which zeta jumps by pi, and what this tells you on this interface, you have half of a quantum Hall current localized, half of an integer quantum Hall current. You get a Hall conductivity, which is half of that, the integer quantum Hall effect. So when you have an interface, turn an electric field, there will be a Hall current flowing on the interface. That has a lot of interesting consequences. For one, if you put an electric charge nearby to this interface, then your typical procedure in electrostatics would have been to calculate the electric field that results from the presence of this interface. You introduce a mirror charge as some technical device, some mirror charge of the electric charge down in your material, and that way you can solve completely for the electric field outside that material. If you do this with a topological insulator, which has a non-trivial zeta, you find that the mirror charge you have to set up doesn't just include an electric charge, it also includes a magnetic charge. A single electric charge produces a magnetic field that looks like the magnetic field of a magnetic monopole, kind of radial pointing outward magnetic field from an electric charge sitting close to the boundary of a topological insulator. Of course, there's not really a monopole because there's no net flux through the whole sphere, but if you only look at the hemisphere that's outside the topological insulator, you see exactly the magnetic flux that you would associate to a magnetic monopole sitting right there inside the material. And one reason I like this is because it was my gateway drug into that sort of subject. If you use electromagnetic invariance, you can write down a very nice and compact formula for that magnetic mirror charge, which otherwise looks quite complicated. One issue is that the expression for the mirror charge involves both mu and epsilon. In 4D, this topological term, this FHF term, has dimension 4 just like the Maxwell term. So unlike in three dimensions where you have Chern Simons dominating the IR physics, in four dimensions, you always have Maxwell and the topological term both contributing at the same level. So whenever you write down any consequences of your topological term, it gets decorated with epsilons and mu's.
Any material with a Broglie time real signature may have
any material. So all the edges in this calculation is zeta. Zeta doesn't have to be 0 or pi. Yeah. But to have a non-zero zeta is the special thing. In Jackson, you will never find zeta with any non-zero value. If you have time reversal invariant, zeta can be 0 pi. If you break time reversal invariant, zeta can be any value you want. So in particular, if you have a standard integer quantum Hall effect, you do a magnetic field, you would have some non-trivial zeta too, and you would see exactly.
So this phenomena would appear, say, on some ferromagnets, which have this...
Yes, this is a funky way of summarizing not that exciting physics did. The interesting thing is this happens without any magnetic fields or anything that naively not. But they explicitly see you should get magnetic fields, especially if it's not just sort of insulating material and it does this. And it sounds much more cool if you call it magnetic monopole. But yes, this is not. No, the fact that Sayla is equal to pi is where time reversal invariance comes in. The fact that a non-zero Sayla generates this G is not. Has nothing to do with the quantum. Okay, the other thing Sayla does for you, it gives you a Faraday and the curl effect, so you send an electromagnetic wave to your. The interface between the topological insulator and here it's a ferromagnet, but it could be vacuum. Then what happens is the polarization, both of the reflected and the transmitted light, gets rotated. Again, if you really turn on magnetic field, you wouldn't be surprised of this happening. So there's some non-trivial, and here the notation in this picture is pretty awful. The theta topo is the contribution to the Faraday rotation due to the topological insulator. And then where the theta from before is hiding, the angle by which light gets rotated is proportional to a delta, where delta is the change in theta. That what happens if you steal transparency from other people. But you would get, with a non-trivial magnetic field, we all know Faraday and Kerr effects happen. The interesting thing is that there's some remnant of the current Faraday rotation that's left, even when your magnetic field gets set to zero. So there's a magnetic field independent contribution to the current Faraday effect, which only, is non-vanishing if there's a non-trivial change in theta, and again it gets decorated with epsilon and mu. So that's a telltale sign of this topological insulator, that you do get, even at zero magnetic field, without breaking time reversal, you get Faraday and Kerr effect. Okay, now I want to describe where this comes from. So how can I generate a non-zero theta? Let me introduce a microscopic model, where to me a microscopic model means a continuum field theory which gives rise, with massive matter, which gives rise to that term if I integrate out the massive matter. To connect to experiment, we'll have to go one more level down into the UV. Okay, the simplest microscopic model that does all this is a single massive Dirac fermion coupled to this U1 electromagnetism field. So here's one, the simplest sort of matter that gives rise to this effect. Time reversal symmetry, it takes basically psi bar psi to psi bar psi star. So time reversal basically is a good symmetry. If I take m to m star, I get back to where I started. So time reversal invariant system can only have a real mass, which still leaves us with two options, a positive or a negative mass. So you see this will be exactly the two options of theta equals 0, theta equals pi. If I didn't have this mass, a massless Dirac fermion has a chiral symmetry under which I can take my left-handed and right-handed fermions to transform differently, so I can do a rotation with a gamma 5 matrix stuck in there. And that is the symmetry of the massive theory if I allow my mass to transform as well. So in other words, I can always use this chiral symmetry, which is only broken by the presence of the mass, to rotate the mass, the phase of my mass, into whatever I want. So even if I start with a complex mass, or I start with a mass that's negative. Naively, I think this phase cannot possibly affect physics because I can always use this explicitly broken chiral symmetry to make the phase go away and choose M to be real and positive. Now, the only reason this doesn't work is because this U1 chiral symmetry is not just explicitly broken by the mass, it's actually also anomalous. The measure of the pass integral isn't invariant under the symmetry, the measure transforms. And if I do this chiral rotation that brings my mass, I can do this chiral rotation, make all my masses real and positive, but the price I have to pay is that I introduce exactly this F wedge F, the E dot B term, into the effective action due to the non-invariance of the measure and the pass integral. And that coefficient that sits out front here, that can simply be calculated by group theory, is just counting all the fields that I know whose mass I rotate times the charge squared of this field. So in this example I just gave you, it's a single field with charge 1, so I get 1 over here. But that's going to be the most important formula for later if you try to generalize this. If I want to calculate what is the theta I generate, all I have to do is calculate this group theory factor. I have to sum over all fields, take the charge of the field squared. And then the effect of this is, if I do this rotation, so I change theta, goes to theta times by how much did I change the phase of my massive Dirac fermion, and now we're almost there. If I start with a negative real mass Dirac fermion and take its mass to rotate into a positive mass, I have to rotate the phase of the mass term by pi, so I generate a theta equals to pi. So if I start out with an electron which has a positive mass to begin with, I get a trivial insulator. But if I start out with an electron as a negative mass, then I get a topological insulator with a theta of equal to pi. Complex mass breaks time reversal. Time reversal takes mass to complex complicate of mass. So for a time reversal to be unbroken, the mass needs to be real. you break time reversal, then you can always, again, you can rotate the mass always to real and positive, but now we generate a theta which doesn't have to be 0, 5, because it can be.
This is all in 3 plus 1, right?
Yeah. This is all in 3 plus 1. There's a similar story in 1 plus 1, you can also use no, this time with the theta F term that you generate this way. That is 3 plus 1. Yes.
Your association between the value of theta and the mass is just a convention, right? You could have started with positive mass and non-zero theta.
Yes, yes. So I could introduce something like a bare theta. So if I start with no theta there, then and the positive mass, I just stick with this. But if I define my standard vacuum to have no theta and positive mass, then the one is negative.
There's no
mass.
Canonical origin.
There's no C2 classification of what you made out of your minor vacuum is the other choice, but. Yeah, there's an overall development to the constant, which is like BSA then. Okay, so as a consequence of this, the topological non-trivial insulator has negative mass, topological trivial insulator has positive mass. You directly see this other effect people talk about when they talk about topological insulators, namely that if you have a domain wall which takes you from a positive mass to a negative mass, or takes you from topological insulator to topological non-trivial insulator, you have to have a localized zero mode on the domain wall. It's exactly the sort of thing lattice gauge theorists would call Kaplan's domain wall fermions. And the domain wall here is this interface, and the only difference is this all taken one dimension down for Kaplan. This all lived in 5 dimensions where the mass was real to begin with. In 4 dimensions, we have to get real masses if we insist on time reversal invariance.
Yes,
question.
So, the IC model
with T slightly greater than TC, and then put it next to an IC model with T slightly less than TC in 1D, say 2 quantum IC model. You're saying there has to be a zero mode on the place where I did this shift? That seems to be the analog of the statement.
The analog of the statement is that if I have a quantum Hall system, I get a.
Well, this has better than 1, that's why I'm asking. This is just.
This is like the jockey for me.
Yes.
No, but Shakib Remy has all these E1s, but right, what you said here seems.
No, this is U1 as well. These are not
right. Enough. Well, that's what I'm asking. Is this true, though, even without the U1s? I mean, that's why I said the IC model.
It's a continuum field theory I'm talking about right now.
No, but the question is whether these fermions are Majorana or Dirac. That's what he's asking.
Yeah, well, that's one way of rephrasing. Yeah.
You already forgot my these fermions.
All right, so then the question is, can one do this for a Majorana fermion as well?
I mean, you needed the anomalous U1 to make these arguments, right?
Yeah, so I needed the Dirac fermion.
There's no anomaly in the.
That's right. It's no meaning to the Z2 anomaly.
Right.
It seems to be the same physics, so that's why.
In that sense, these topological insulators, they sit together with a nice family of similar phenomena. In 5 dimensions, you basically can have the same thing. You take a matter content on the domain wall, which you'd usually think has an axion and normally a single chiral fermion. But it's normally can be absorbed by 4 plus 1 dimensional bulk. Then you get these domain wall fermions. Here we end up with a very similar situation. We get a single Dirac fermion localized on this domain wall, which in 2 plus 1 dimensions, you'd usually say has a parity anomaly, but it doesn't. Because the anomaly gets soaked up by the bulk, and then the 1 plus 1 version of this is where the chiral anomalies of the edge state living on the boundary, which gets absorbed by the anomaly of the bulk turn signs here in the quantum Hall physics. So this was really a missing ingredient. The reason it took much longer to discover is this is only C2 classification, and the other ones are C classification. Okay, to go towards the experiment, you have to go one more level deep into the UV. This is the part where I don't understand much about, but you know all this much better than I do. Now, if you want to get theta equals pi in a real material, now you don't just want to talk about a single Dirac fermion, which is like the last filled, first unfilled band you modeled by a single Dirac fermion. You really have to take into account all the other heavy fermions if you want to take account of the full band structure. And then the question is whether this last Dirac fermion that you still want to keep for a while, does it have a positive mass or negative mass? How do I know? Well, the claim is it has all something to do with the topology of the band structure. You can define a C2 value topological invariant of the band structure to distinguish trivial positive mass from the non-trivial case negative mass. Now, here is this topological invariant, something that Barry Fay integrated about the filled bands and stuff like this. But the important thing is that there are people out there who know how to calculate this, and now you can take a list of all your favorite band insulators. So these are all free fermions, just free fermions in some non-trivial periodic potential. And you can make a list. You can write on all the insulators that have theta equals 0, which turns out to be most of them, including vacuum. But there's this ever-growing list of topological insulators where just by staring at the band structure, you can figure out they have theta equals to pi. And you have all these interesting materials, and then there are much more now that have been predicted.
that are supposed to be topological insulators having zeta equals phi. Now we can go for them, hunt for them experimentally. So the thing people look for is this localized zero mode on the boundary. So here a bunch of pictures. The important thing you see in all of them is there's some colored triangle. So I don't really know what people do there, but every single one of those pictures shows you a Dirac mode is living on the surface of one of these materials.
One more back. So that formula there, you're saying there's an explicit formula for theta given some band structure that you get by integrating some topological density over.
So this FI theta is kind of this Berry phase connection. That's the same thing if you integrate this in the, for the quantum Hall effect, the integral of F itself is some integer, and now you get some more complicated expression in terms of the Berry connection. You integrate over the occupied bands. And that is still known as C2 invariant topology.
So if you know a hell of a lot about a material, you could do this a priori and decide whether...
And that's how these guys are discovered. Okay. Somebody did the calculation on the computer. And
so the issue is that spin orbit is doing a lot of the work. Without spin orbit, you cannot do it.
Yeah. These materials, the blue ones, these are things where people did the band structure calculation but haven't done so far. They're looking for them in triangles, but no, that probably will happen soon. The summary of the strategy, since I employ the same strategy as we move on in the talk. So we talked about this topological insulator now at three levels, and we went to increasingly shorter and shorter length scales. And the level of the low energy effective theory itself, and I only talk about the Maxwell fields, it was a Dirac quantization that told me that zeta has to be an integer times pi. On the microscopic model, I could use this ABJ anomaly, the axial anomaly, to calculate that zeta over pi was equal to the charge squared of all those fields if I assume I have, in the non-trivial case, in the trivial case, zeta was just zero, because my mass was really positive to begin with. That's going to be the main important formula as we go forward. In order to connect to experiment, I had to go one more level down into the UV, where I can understand that the same zeta gives me this invariant based on the topology of band. So this is going to be the level at which we're going to move forward for the rest of the talk. Fortunately, I can do the rest of the talk on this level, which would be much more exciting. And again, I increasingly integrate out more and more degrees of freedom. So here I have the full band structure, only the last band, one Dirac fermion that has to do all the job, and only the Maxwell field up there. So now we can ask ourselves the question, this was all about free band insulators. Can I move on and generalize this concept to fraction topological insulators? Just as a reminder of what happened in the Hall physics, people know that for basically free electrons, you can get the quantum Hall effect. If you turn on the interactions, you can get the quantum Hall effect. You get this fractionalized quantum Hall currents. And one way to think about it is that basically what's happening is your electron fractionalizes into m partons, and then this m sits down here in your denominator, and m for fermions therefore got to be odd, since to break up a fermion to the other fermions, you need an odd number of fermions to make a fermion. So the question which I want to answer is, can I generalize the concept of the topological insulator where on the surface I have half of an integer quantum Hall state to the concept of a fraction topological insulator, which then should have on its surface half of a fractional quantum Hall state. In particular, the easiest example will be the one where I have half of a Lovelace state sitting on the surface. Can we get this from charge fractionalization? All right. The simplest model is to just go ahead and assume that somehow you take the electron, you break it up into a bunch of partons without specifying anything about the dynamics of how this is going to happen, what's the actual dynamics of this. You can immediately see that it works because our formula for zeta over pi only involves the chiral anomaly. So the moment I broke up my electron into three partons, I can again calculate this coefficient C, the thing that makes the chiral anomaly tick. I need to sum over all the fields, take the charge squared. Each parton, if I broke up my electron into three partons, each one of them has to have charge a third, so I add up to charge one to build up my partons. So each one of them has charge a third, so I get 1 over m squared times n because I have m partons. So I immediately see that I get a zeta equals 1 over m times pi as opposed to just pi. So all you need to get a fractional topological insulator is somehow make your electron break up into m partons, and you're done. You don't...
Actually, there's something confusing about the way you said that, which is anomaly matching. I mean, if you actually had a description with the electron and a good effective theory with the U1, the anomaly would match. So you don't really need that, right?
Well, if you match, then you wouldn't get a fractional.
Exactly. So you can't. I mean, to call that an electron fractionalizing.
if you have, you know, if your basic degrees of freedom in your system are three partons with charges served, then you get a fraction quantum Hall effect. And now what you want to do, you want to ensure somehow that it's not, so at this level your partons are the basic physical building blocks, not the electron. You want to introduce some statistical gauge field, some extra gauge field that ensures that the only physical states always require there to be three partons. You can never have a single parton all by itself. The simplest model seems to be SU3 with n is equals to 1. So you just take SU3 gauge field with one flavor, then the only gauge invariant states are either mesons, which are charge neutral, you're taking, you know, parton and antiparton pH. If you want to get anything that actually carries electric charge, you'd have to form a baryon out of three quarks, and you get an electron. Oh, that's what used to be called the baryon, now it's called the electron. There are two problems with SU3. Let me first introduce this one. In a relativistic field theory, you know, the electron in the non-Abelian gauge field would always end up having spin m over 2, because if I need to be completely anti-symmetric in my Carnot indices, I need to be completely symmetric in spins, so all the spins of my partons line up. So if I take m spin a half partons, I would end up with spin m over 2 electrons. So my electron would suddenly have spins v a half. My collaborator assured me that they don't care, because in condensed matter, spin always is a different thing anyway, but in a relativistic field theory, I certainly would care. There's an alternative version of this where you can
only three dimensions. In three dimensions, spin is spin.
But in any case, there's this very simple generalization of this model which avoids this problem, will also avoid the one I'm about to talk about next. You can have, it's completely sufficient to introduce only a Abelian gauge series, where you basically introduce a bunch of Abelian gauge series, and the partons are just little arrows to indicate that this parton would have charge minus one under this Abelian gauge series, charge plus one under that Abelian gauge series. That is what we would call a quiver model in high energy physics. But the main point of this is you only need basically two U1s, which are like the Cartan generator of the SU3 I wrote down before. You introduce a bunch of U1s, which are the Cartan U1s of the SUM. That's all that you need in order to assure that the only gauge invariant states are three partons. If you see here, if you have this parton alone, it's not gauge invariant because it carries charge under this and this U1. You might take the product of this parton with that parton. Now, because this carries charge plus one and this U1 charge this one carries charge minus one. Now you're neutral under this U1, but you're still charged under that one and that one. But if you take the product of all the partons, then you're gauge invariant under all the U1. So as soon as you quiver gauge here, you're automatically sure that the only gauge invariant objects you can write down are either mesons, which are not neutral, so there's some extra neutral matter around, but the only charged gauge invariant objects you can write down are these baryon-like objects, which are a product of m partons. If you write down some more generic version of this with a bunch of different gauge group factors, it's easy to achieve that you can get Hall currents, which are not just 1 over odd integer, but you can make any odd integer divided by another odd integer. An important dynamical question is, what do I want my gauge field to do? Do I want this to be deconfined or confined? And I think it's very clear that we want this gauge field to be deconfined. So there are lots of problems that arise if you insist on it being confined. If you insist on it being confined, then the chiral symmetry which I'm using is typically broken. I don't want that to happen. On the level of the Dirac quantization, if all my electrons in this problem goes to what you were saying before, if all my partons are tightly collapsed back to the electron, I'm back to having my standard Dirac quantization. In order to relax, theta has to be equal to pi. I need to modify Dirac quantization, so I need to see Dirac quantization associated with partons, not the Dirac quantization associated with the electron. So I do want my gauge group to deconfine. Now, the Abelian models I wrote down before, those already are deconfined to begin with, so it's certainly easy to do this. If you prefer a non-Abelian model because it looks so cool if you realize QCD in the topological insulator, you'll always have to introduce some extra neutral matter to make sure that SU3 with one flavor would confine, but SU3 with one flavor and some extra neutral adjoint stuff floating around would be in a deconfining phase. So you can even make the non-Abelian gauge fields deconfined. To my great surprise, the easiest example of a topological insulator I could think of in this spirit would be you take n equals 4 super anvils, you add a bunch of massive hypermultiplets to it, you get a topological insulator. We actually verified using some ADCFD calculation that we get exactly the right fractional quantum Hall current on the surface. Now, many of you probably will not understand why this part of the audience over there finds this amusing, but I certainly found this very amusing because this is a theory I've been trying very hard to get away from by studying some real condensed matter problem, but it comes back to bite me. Okay, how do I make such a fractional topological insulator? I can't really tell you since I didn't go all the way down to the microscopic lattice model. Right now I wrote down an effective theory for you which would have all the features of a fractional topological insulator. I do not have a good microscopic model for you which would realize the Lorentz effective theory. All I can tell you that these are the two things you need. You need strong electron-electron interaction so that my electron can effectively fractionalize. And I need strong spin-orbit coupling so that the partons can form a topological insulator. What I can tell you is, if you have a material like this, how would you be able to tell that you actually have a fractional topological insulator and not something else? On the level of transport measurements, if you turn on some big external magnetic field in order to make sure that the two quantum Hall currents align, all you would see is the sum of the two surfaces of your sample. You would, in transport, see a standard fractional quantum Hall effect. But if you do the Faraday...
quantum Hall effect on the boundary.
Yes. No, there's insulator in the bulk, no currents flowing in the bulk. If you turn electric field, the only currents are flowing in the boundary, and you see the sum of the two boundary layers heading up.
Which you need fractionalization in the bulk here. Right?
Yes.
So they are actually integer quantum Hall state for the fractionally charged particle.
Yes. Yeah. So if you get rid of, if you make the zero thickness, then this just looks, if you think of those two layers as just being a single layer with almost plus no material in between, this is just a fractional quantum Hall effect where you took the 2 plus 1 charge carrier and broke it up. Each one of the partners sees a standard integer quantum Hall effect. The special thing is here that by putting the decomposed material in the bulk, you can kind of split the one fractional quantum Hall layer into two half fractional quantum Hall layers on the two surfaces. This is the same that the topological insulator did for you in terms of the integer quantum Hall effect. You take one integer quantum Hall effect, you split into two half integer quantum Hall effects living on the two surfaces. But on the level of transport, you can't see the difference. On the level of Faraday and Kerr effect, you only reflect off, at least for the Kerr effect, where you look at the rotation in the reflected light, you reflect off one surface layer, not both. So you really see this change in theta associated with half of the interface. You only see half the fractional quantum Hall effect, not all of it. So the combination of transport measurement and Kerr effect should give you a very clear telltale sign that you have one of those fractional topological insulators.
Meaning that it have an anion extension or things like that. And here one probably is the...
There are no anions in the system, yeah. Right? You can write on the surface state in terms of one of these K matrices, but the K matrix which we get this way, if you just calculate all the statistic angles, you get this particular set. K matrix, they end up being zeros and pi's only.
Yeah.
So it fits in the same language, but it's not the most general quantum fraction quantum Hall that you get this way. You don't get anything in the anion. On the level of transport and Kerr effect, you wouldn't be able to distinguish this one from this one. I think from the theory, it should be very clear whether you have an actually one of these fractional topological insulators or whether all you did is you take a standard topological insulator and deposited some extra layer on the top which has a fractional quantum Hall effect. There are some in principle differences between those two systems. So here's one experimental procedure how you could distinguish them. You go out to the cosmic radiation, you catch yourself a magnetic monopole, you stick it inside that material, you measure the net electric flux that comes out, and then you would know that you have a fractional topological insulator, not just a standard topological insulator with a surface layer of quantum Hall effect. Exactly. If you don't want to do this, there's also a different thing you could do, which is probably experimentally about as feasible, but theoretically much more appealing. You can ask yourself, what is the ground state degeneracy of the system? There's going to be a big difference in the ground state degeneracy you get from a genuine fractional topological insulator, whether a standard topological insulator with a fractional quantum Hall effect sitting on the surface. Okay, on a non-trivial three-manifold, the ground state can be degenerate. And the degeneracy is different for those two systems which I just introduced. And it's also different for another candidate of a fractional topological insulator, which was introduced by the MIT folks, and I'll talk about in a second. Which torus? A sweet torus or... Okay, sweet toruses would not be degenerate. Not degenerate. It is not, and I comment, so there's this theorem by Sentinel and McGreevy and two others, which I comment on that is not contradicting anything we've been doing. Okay, let me just do the ground state degeneracy and then we'll get to the T3. I start with the other examples where we actually do get a non-trivial degeneracy. But how does calculation work on the level for the quantum Hall effect? So for the quantum Hall effect, you basically want to describe a transignment of level m. The equations of motion of transignment show you that the field strength has to be zero. So the degrees of freedom which you want to study when you study the ground states are just the flat connections. On R2, there is no flat connection, right? Any gauge field that doesn't have a field strength can be gauged the way. But on the torus, you have the Wilson lines. You can calculate the Wilson line around the two circles. You call these two parameters x and y. The Wilson lines are periodic, so x and y you can interpret as being the positions of a particle on the torus. So the Wilson, the value the Wilson lines take are like the positions of some auxiliary particle living on the torus. So if you want to understand the ground state degeneracy in the quantum Hall system, you have to study quantum mechanics of a particle moving on the torus. The transiemence term itself in terms of the Wilson line gives me like A dA gives me a Y X dot for this quantum mechanics. So in terms of this quantum mechanics of the particle on the torus, this looks like the contribution of a magnetic field. So if you want to count the ground states of transiemence theory, what you need to count is the ground states of a particle on a torus with m units of magnetic flux. That has a degeneracy of m just from the lowest Landau level. So the ground state degeneracy of the fractional quantum Hall effect is an m, and if you put this on a genus G Riemann surface, the only new thing is you have more Wilson lines. You have 2G non-contractible cycles. Each one of them comes with a Wilson line. So you study particle on a bigger torus. You still have your m units of magnetic flux, and you just get from every one of those Wilson line pairs, you get one factor of m, so you get m to the genus of the Riemann surface you study your quantum Hall physics. How does this work for us? Let us first study this particular example of topological non-trivial manifold, where my three-dimensional manifold is an interval times a torus. So I have a line which goes from 0 to 1, and at every point of the line, I have a torus. Yes? 5 minutes, okay.
That should be fine.
So if I have this system which I first discussed, it's just a topological insulator with a fractional quantum Hall effect on the surface, then each one of these fractional quantum Hall effects on the surface will have its own m to the g degeneracy. They don't know anything about each other, so the total degeneracy is just this mg squared. But if I have a genuine topological, fractional topological insulator, then to be on the vacuum, I need to have f squared equals 0, which tells me that the change of A along this extra direction, this would be associated with a magnetic field. If A weren't constant along this interval, I would have a non-trivial magnetic field. I would not study a vacuum configuration, would carry some non-trivial energy. So in this case, the flat connection on the torus on one boundary has to be equal to the flat connection of the torus on the other boundary has to be equal to the flat connection on the torus everywhere along this interval. So I only see the ground state degeneracy associated to one of these flat connections. I only get a single m to the g as opposed to the m to the g squared. M is the number of partons my system broke up into. So this is talking about the system where the surface Hall conductance is a half of a Loveland state. It's 1 over m Hall conductance.
In terms of parton, the surface state is an integer quantum Hall state, so there is no degeneracy. It's not fractional quantum Hall state in terms of parton.
I can reduce this all to a single transiemence theory with transiemence level m. On the boundary, I have half of a standard quantum Hall physics. So I can
write out a big K matrix with kind of m entries, or I integrate out all the off-diagonal ones to get a K matrix with single entry, but if I calculate the ground state degeneracy, it's just one of those K matrices, I get the same thing.
But doesn't that require that
you need charge quantization.
Yeah, but doesn't that require that your bulk action should have an FF dual term with a coefficient that is a fraction? So that it integrates into a
I do have a fraction theta sitting in the bucket.
So then you need to break the reverse.
That was the whole point about this anomaly argument. I do not have to break time reverse.
But you have in the bulk a term with a theta.
Yeah, the theta in the theory I calculated for you is 1 over n times pi. I have without breaking time reverse in advance, I get a theta as a fraction of theta.
And their states are charged E over m.
The Dirac quantization is modified because the basic electric charge is E over m, so the basic magnetic flux is m times what is also basic.
That's the definition of the charge.
Not the definition of the charge, it's the value of the charge. Flux quantization gets modified. Theta can be fractional in the system without breaking time reverse invariance. You just take m partons, each of them has a theta, that has a negative mass, you integrate them out, you generate a theta that is pi over m. And you didn't break time reversal invariance, you had a good real mass for all the particles integrated out. And the original argument by say there will be zero pi gets modified because that relies on Dirac flux quantization. Dirac flux quantization cares about whether your basic electric charge is E or E omega. The claim would be in this material, the only magnetic fluxes that we can have that are only Maxwell fluxes have to be m times what you would have told me is a basic magnetic flux. Flux quantization gets modified. The only good pure Maxwell fluxes are m of what the standard magnetic flux
is. So the claim then is that if there was a charge, the confined phase of QCD, you would have this.
If you do see a deconfined phase of QCD, you would see that. Yes.
That's what you claim.
That is known, I think, that it's not just something I claim, that is what ABJ normally calculates for you. That I don't think this is a controversial statement, what the ABJ normally does. That's what happens if you take a bunch of quotes, integrate them out. People have been looking at the system, and if it is one, as you
see. I know that quite well. That's not the issue. The issue here is that I thought in order to get the fractional state of lambda, you need to break the reversal.
No. This is time reversal invariant fractions of lambda.
Well, in order to see the quantum Hall state on the surface, you need to break time reversal on the surface, but not in the bulk.
Well, that's not what is being done here.
Yeah, the bulk is completely time reversal invariant and has a fraction of theta. That was achieved by breaking up, deconfining the end from the bulk. Okay, the ground state, what you see? The ground state on G3 is trivial if you know, because there's just no space for my. I have three of these flat connections and there's no kinetic term for them whatsoever. The F doesn't give me any. The F just vanishes on flat connections because at least one of those F has to be a magnetic piece. There's a theorem proven by the MIT folks that there cannot be any fraction theta unless the ground state is on G3 is degenerate. But there. Theorem assumes that you have a gap for all excitations. In our system, the only excitations that are gapped are the charged excitations. I have these extra deconfined gauge fields. I have an extra bunch of U1 gauge fields or a bunch of N equals 4 gauge fields, whichever you prefer, but they're extra massless gauge fields around. So what the system is, it is still an insulator because all charge fields in my system are gapped, but there are a bunch of neutral extra fields around, or phonons, you can call them, or just the phonons in the system are some non-abelian N equals 4 sigma mils or a bunch of abelian U1s. But there's extra massless stuff around which would certainly dominate the low energy heat capacity. But low temperature heat capacity will not contribute to charge transport because it's all neutral. And you can explicitly see if you go in how they prove their theorem. Their theorem is basically just Dirac flux quantization. If you have these extra U1s around, they will, in line one, they'll modify the argument that was given in the paper. So the extra massless fields that we have around, they allow you to have this fractional theta without the ground state degeneracy and T-sphere. But if... So on a T-sphere, all these, the gauge fields are all gapped by 1 over the volume. So there will be a huge degeneracy of states which are...
That's not that means degeneracy. Degeneracy really means it's finite gap. So you have gap excitation means actually, in some sense, like a half degeneracy level.
Well, yeah. Distinguish exponential from power law gap.
Yeah, so the true ground state degeneracy on T3 is non-degenerate. If you want to call it ground state degeneracy, everything that has an energy that goes to zero as you take the volume to infinity, there would be something. But in that case, there's a well-defined notion of a ground state degeneracy here, which has this feature that it's only a finite dimension space if you study it on T3, and as you decompactify your T3, there will be this whole new infinite tower of new light states that comes down, whose mass is only 1 over L. But on this V, there's on the sigma times T2, there's some truly some truly zero energy states that are separated by a scale 1 over this volume of my box from this continuum that you get from the extra light term. So it's a matter of what you want to call ground state degeneracy. In the system, there's a well-defined notion of ground state degeneracy on a finite volume manifold, which only depends on the topology of the manifold. It's you're absolutely right that there are a lot of extra light states around whose mass is only given by 1 over the size of the ball. Don't think I have much else other than conclusions. Yeah. So what I've done today, I constructed for you the effective field theory for a fractional time reversal invariant topological insulator that can be constructed. The basic ingredient, all you need is the fractionalization of charge, and everything else follows from the ABJ anomaly. In order to realize this in the experiment, what you would require is strong LS coupling and strong interactions. But while I don't know how to do this in a microscopic model, I gave you experimental signatures you would have been looking for, and that's transport in the Kerr or Faraday rotation.
theory by Levin and Stern, which actually Mike Levin spoke about last week here. Is your result consistent with their
general? I don't know their series, so you need to tell me a little bit about it.
Theirs is in two dimensions. It's like the fractional, two-dimensional Tavlos-Goins theory.
All right. Yes. All right.
Thank you. Thank you.
My understanding is this topological insulator is not topological in the sense if you break convolutional symmetry, it became a band insulator. It's indistinguishable. I kind of wonder whether you have similar thing in the fractionalized case. That's my feeling is that if you break convolutional symmetry, you still have a new phase. In a sense, a fractionalized case is fundamentally topological, have a non-trivial topological order. So in a sense, even your break convolutional symmetry is distinct from, it's different from the trivial one.
So one thing that it shares with a integer fraction topological insulator is as soon as you break time reversal invariant, the zeta parameter cannot just be zero or pi over m, but now can be continuously deformed.
Yeah,
but I agree there's a new integer around which is this m, which is the number of patterns my state fractionalizes into, and that is a topological quantum number that will be present even. So there are two things that are topological here. One is that zeta can only take on a bunch of discrete values, which is guaranteed by time reversal invariance, right? It's not like breaking time reversal invariant doesn't make zeta unphysical. The only thing it doesn't make it a topological parameter because it can be smoothly deformed. That would be clear through zeta as a discrete parameter. I can only deform in steps if I insist on time reversal. If I break time reversal, I can smoothly deform it. But the number of patterns, that's something I cannot smoothly deform. That
is, if you have break convolutional, that's the universal.
Right, so there will be, instead of having the integer m and my fraction zeta, I only have the integer m, no longer the fraction zeta.
So the fractionalization is robust, basically.
Yeah, there's something topological about the fractionalization. I certainly agree with that.
Okay, let's thank Andrea.